from deep inside your radio.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm in London, England.
I'd hate to call you a liar, but I don't believe you.
Rupert, I'm in London, England. And ladies and gentlemen, as you probably know, if you're in the United States, the U.S. news media have been wall-to-wall Aurora this weekend. They can't help themselves. Of course, the understandable stories about the victims and their families, but also the less understandable return to the, now it's time to really have a discussion of guns and the gun laws. Yeah, that's going to go anywhere. And, of course, the inimitable spectacle of our politicians, especially in a presidential campaign year, just looking around, trying to, as if to say, how long do I have to keep looking sad before I can start looking angry again? Well, we're not going to be in that world today. There's, as I say, it's wall to wall everywhere else. But there is a crack in that wall, in at least the Washington Post, which I'm reading online. And I don't very often wish this broadcast was on television. We're on television for obvious reasons. But I wish it were today, just for the moment where I could flash, pardon the expression. I'm not in the Tiki Theater, officer. Move along, nothing to see here. I wish I could flash the news photo that's in the story about the taking down of Joe Paterno. He was the Penn State football coach for decades. Taking down his statue on the Penn State campus in the wake of the report by former FBI Director Louis Freeh about the Jerry Sandusky sex abuse scandal, which was very critical of the late Coach Paterno for not reporting what he knew about Sandusky's proclivities and activities to the authorities. And the photograph has, as I say, I would just flash it, pardon me, on your screens and then, you know, return to the radio. But let me describe it to you with the power of words that has been granted to me. It's a bunch of workmen in white hard hats, and above them looms the head of Joe Paterno on this statue, which has been covered in a blue tarp. Now, supposedly, according to the news stories, the entire statue was covered with a blue tarp, but this photo proves them wrong because poking out from the tarp is the dark bronze right arm of Paterno with one finger upraised. The first glance declares it to be the index finger, and then Mr. Imagination takes over. All right, so we're not on the television, but I've done my best. Ladies and gentlemen, support the troops. Thousands of newly released documents about water contamination at the Marine Corps base at Camp Lejeune add to the evidence, that's in Raleigh, North Carolina, that the military long knew about tainted tap water blamed for deaths and illnesses of Marines and their families, and that officials covered up the information for years. On Thursday, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, released more than 8,500 Department of Defense documents relating to the water contamination that continued at the base for decades. This is the same week the Senate approved a bill to provide health care for Marines and their relatives who suffered due to the contamination. So, yes, we paid for that. Water supplied to Camp Lejeune's main family housing areas was contaminated by dry cleaning solvents and other sources from the 50s until 1987. Health officials believe as many as 1 million people may have been exposed to tainted water, but at least their clothes were clean. And, ladies and gentlemen, we're not number one. We are so not number one. As a matter of fact, we are not number one. Just had to wait for that. For the first time in recent history, the average Canadian is richer than the average American, according to data from Environics Analysis Wealthscapes. Name your company better. Or more modern, Environics Analytics Wealthscapes, published in the Toronto Globe and Mail. The net worth of the average Canadian household in 2011 was $363,000, while the average American household's net worth was $319,000. These are not 60-cent dollars. Canada's dollar is more or less at par with the U.S. dollar. These figures also ignore public sector, that is, government debt that presumably people on both sides of the border will someday have to pay. Such debt is higher in the U.S. as a percentage of GDP than it is in Canada. Canada is also trumping the U.S. when it comes to employment. Canada's unemployment rate is 7.2% compared to America's 8.2%. Another way that we, ladies and gentlemen, be proud. Say it proudly. We are not number one. Well, as you know, in about 5 days, the Olympic Games begin in London, Ontario, Canada. No, sorry, in London, here in London, England. I had that misinformation from my staff. And I am in London, Rupert, despite what you said.
I'm sorry, I take that back.
All right, that's okay. No problem. And so there will be much coverage of the Olympic Games on this broadcast, beginning with... Yeah, I'll say. Beginning with news of the Olympic movement. Here it is. Right here. Right now. News of the Olympic movement. Produced by Jim Ebersole, Jr. First of all, baseball and softball have agreed to merge as a single international federation in a joint bid to return to the Olympics. The two sports were dropped from the Olympics after the 2008 Beijing Games. Each has failed in separate attempts to win reinstatement. The two governing bodies say they plan to merge into the International Baseball and Softball Federation in hopes of increasing their chances of returning for the 2020 Games. If only synchronized swimming and rhythmic gymnastics would merge. Then you'd have something. Nick Simons is flashing his deltoid like a well-aimed middle finger at the Olympic sponsorship system this year, reports Ad Week. The media-savvy American middle-distance runner, who easily qualified, spent recent months challenging highly controlled branding rules that he and many competitors believe reward everyone but the actual athletes. His gesture to the system began earlier this year when he auctioned off a patch of his skin on eBay, sparking a bidding war among 85 brands wanting to advertise on his body. Milwaukee outdoor lifestyle agency Hanson Dodge Creative snagged the space for $11,000, a branding coup made all the more valuable because the handsome 28-year-old track star convinced Paris Hilton once to go on a date with him. The tattoo is temporary. The reasons behind Simon's one-man campaign to fund himself and tweak the powers that be are lasting. The Olympics will generate $6 to $7 billion, possibly more, in sponsorship and ad revenue, yet many of the more than 10,000 athletes competing this summer struggle to get by financially. At the games this week, Simmons will continue to wear a tattoo with the agency's Twitter handle stenciled on his left arm. The rules require him to cover the words during meets. The swatch of white sports tape whizzing by on his muscle will be visible as a gesture of defiance to the Olympic world. So many Olympians, he says, are living below the poverty line. In related news, Olympic ticket holders will be free to wear the clothing of their choice inside games venues, according to organizers, despite the Olympic delivery chairman Lord Coe saying people wearing advertising logos of non-Olympic sponsors would be turned away. In an interview on BBC Radio 4's Today program, Coe said the Olympic Organizing Committee, LOCOG, had a responsibility to protect the commercial rights of sponsors. He said spectators would not be able to gain entry wearing a Pepsi t-shirt, but they would probably get in wearing Nike tennis shoes. Speaking on radio, Coe said, "We had to raise, through the organizing committee, a mountainous amount of money from the private sector. We do it through sponsorship, and we do it through broadcasting rights. We have to protect the rights of the sponsor." But responding after the broadcast, LOCOG said, "As an individual, you are free to wear clothing of your choice in force, including sneakers." I affirmed this would also include a T-shirt emblazoned with a non-sponsor's logo, adding the rules were different for those working at venues. And there's more. While being awarded the 2008 Summer Olympics allowed Beijing to construct new architectural icons, its current reality is a collection of unused sports facilities with few, if any, plans for reuse. It could take 30 years to pay off the $471 million bill for the bird's nest. The Water Cube lost about $1 million last year, even after public financial assistance and the addition of a water park. And those are the facilities still in use. Venues for kayaking, beach volleyball, BMX, and baseball sit untouched since 2008. Signage and landscaping appear to have gone without maintenance since the closing ceremonies. This is according to The Atlantic. Beijing is left with a post-Olympics landscape that better suits the taste of ruin porn aficionados than urban development officials. It's a story that should serve as a warning not only to London, but future cities that have their sights set on investing billions into new infrastructure for a 2.5-week-long event. And the Environmental Transport Association has looked into the regulations on the Games Lanes, the 30 miles of road in central London exclusively reserved for use during the event by the Games family. 95% of them will be off-limits to bicyclists. The Games Lanes, not positioned by the sidewalk, but in the center of the road, is a no-go area. Situation is made even more troubling by the fact that bus lanes, which the ETA says offer a refuge from London's busier traffic, will be removed from roads with Games Lanes. By the way, Peter Ueberroth, who ran the L.A. Games, was in the papers this week reminding us of how this all started. L.A. got the Olympics in a year where nobody else competed because Montreal had almost gone bankrupt. I think they had gone bankrupt. And Moscow's games had been ruined by the U.S. boycott. So he said the L.A. Games of 84 were an austerity games modeled after the London Games of 1948, right after World War II. Not a cent of public money was used because the L.A. city government prohibited the use of public money, and so private sponsors were introduced. And he says he's looking forward to this year's games, where he says the complaining will stop as soon as the sports begin. What he forgot to mention was that at this Olympics, £1 billion has been raised privately. The total budget is more than £11 billion. The gap is provided by the public. In a period when school teachers are being laid off and hospitals are being, you know, it's austerity time. News of the Olympic movement. The Olympics. It's a movement. And we all need one. Every day! Hello, welcome to the show.
static and soft to the touch. Then I gotta believe in the one who loves. I gotta believe in the one who loves. You must have thought about it, the way you live without it. It must have risen like a wave inside you. The way you brought it out, and then you checked it out. I know exactly what was denied you. You pick a category, let me complete the story, cause you know that.
From the semi-unofficial British Olympic News Centre, this is Simon Aldridge with an Olympic News update. Four new Olympic brand infringement detention facilities have been opened in undisclosed locations around London. According to organising committee officials, speaking on condition of sobriety, the facilities are meant to house merchants and others trying to infringe on the exclusivity of the Olympic rings, the image of a flame, and the words Olympic, Games, Sport, 2012, Drive, Ambition, and The. Violators will be brought before specially commissioned magistrates within 12 hours of their apprehension, and in a change of policy, instead of heavy fines, convicted infringers will be compelled to participate in the Games' closing ceremonies. In other news, there's been a late development in the expanding controversy over the failure of the private security company G4S to supply the promised number of personnel to comply with its contract to secure the Games. Now, British Olympic News has learnt, in addition to UK police and military troops, supplementary security patrolling will be carried out by 2,000 robots supplied by the Japanese government. While uniformed, the robots will be distinguishable by their machine-like appearance. According to officials, if the robots perform their tasks satisfactorily, they may be the first option for security duties at future Olympic Games. I'm Simon Aldridge. That's your Olympic update.
From just outside, just above, actually, Leicester Square in London, England, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news from outside the bubble. The British Bankers Association, BBA, issued a warning to banks way back in April 2008 to submit honest rates to its LIBOR setting panel. That's the London Interbank Offered Rate, the target interest rate, or the standard interest rate for setting many other rates around the world. That's according to a series of emails which demonstrate that the problems with the crucial interest rate were being discussed at the highest level during the financial crisis. This is according to The Guardian. The warning is revealed in 80 pages of emails from 2008 released by the Bank of England as part of its attempt to deflect criticism that it had been warned by regulators in New York about problems with the rate-setting system. The emails show that the BBA, which oversees the setting of LIBOR, had wanted the Bank of England to take a bigger role in the rate-setting process but was rebuffed by the central bank. LIBOR is set by a panel of banks which are asked the price at which they think they might be able to borrow money rather than the actual price at which they could borrow. An internal email at the Bank of England sent by an employee whose name has been redacted tells Paul Tucker, deputy governor of the bank, of the, quote, long-standing perception that LIBOR, by virtue of the manner in which it is set, is open to distortion. Panel banks have no obligation to trade or to have traded at rates that they submit, so it is at least plausible that these are influenced by commercial incentives. That memo, dated May 22, 2008, describes confidence in LIBOR back then as fragile and mentions the, quote, powerful incentive for banks to, quote, avoid the stigma of submitting high rates, which might demonstrate they were in financial difficulty. It was copied to other bank officials. Who could have imagined? Who could have known? Also from The Guardian, Pakistan plans to cancel refugee status for all Afghans living in Pakistan at the end of this year, leaving some 3 million displaced people, the world's biggest cluster of refugees, facing possible expulsion to a country that many barely know. Pushing the refugees into Afghanistan might create a new crisis for that country. The West is pressing Pakistan to not do this. The international community and the Afghan government have no strategy prepared to deal with any such influx of people. However, Pakistan's top administrator in charge of the Afghan refugee issue, Habibullah Khan, says Islamabad will not relent. The refugees have become a threat to law and order, security, demography, economy, and local culture, he said. Enough is enough. He could run for president. If the international community is so concerned, he said, they should open the doors of their countries to these refugees. Afghans will be more than happy to be absorbed by Western Europe, USA, Canada, Australia. Ooh. He knows how to hurt us. Pakistan has hosted Afghan refugees for more than 30 years after they fled the Soviet invasion. Whole generations have grown up in Pakistan. Haven't they suffered enough? And do not know their homeland. It's the largest and longest-running refugee problem in the world. Well, if those refugees are long-running, they should be in the... No, come on now. There are currently 1.7 million Afghan refugees in Pakistan, more than half of them under the age of 18. Khan declined to spell out what would happen to the refugees after the end of the year, but if the policy sticks, they will all be in the country illegally and liable to be thrown out. Earlier this year, Baroness Amos... You know, she hangs out with Baron Andy. The former British cabinet minister, who is now the UN humanitarian affairs chief, said she was appalled by the conditions for returning refugees in Kabul. She visited a camp for them there. Once they reach Afghanistan, returnees are entitled to a one-time payment of $150 per person from the UN. That should last them. Well, it is Kabul, after all. And the world's super rich have taken advantage of lax tax rules to siphon off at least $21 trillion, possibly as much as 32, from their home countries and hide it abroad, a sum larger than the entire American economy. That's according to James Henry, a former chief economist at McKinsey & Company, a management consultancy firm, and an expert on tax havens. He's concluded groundbreaking new research for the Tax Justice Network, a campaign group, sifting through data from the Bank for International Settlements, the International Monetary Fund, and private sector analysts to construct a picture that shows capital flooding out of countries across the world and disappearing into the offshore world. The report entitled The Price of Offshore Revisited says despite the professed determination of the leading economies to tackle tax secrecy, investors in scores of countries, including the U.S. and the U.K., still can hide some or all of their assets from the tax man. Now they tell me. This offshore economy is large enough to have a major impact on estimates of inequality of wealth and income, on estimates of national income and debt ratios, and to have very significant negative impacts on the domestic tax bases of source countries, says Henry. And those countries include debtor countries in Africa, such as Nigeria, which probably wouldn't be in debt if the income of their wealthiest citizens were not so diverted out of the tax system, he concludes. News from outside the bubble, ladies and gentlemen. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. The TSA, Transportation Security Administration, an arm of our government, you might think, is required to follow the law, follow court rulings, and you would be wrong. It's been a year since a federal court appeals court set aside a constitutional challenge trying to stop the government from using intrusive body scanners at the airports. But the U.S. Court of Appeals for District of Columbia's decision last July also ordered the TSA to act promptly and hold public hearings and publicly adopt rules and regulations about the scanner's use. The TSA has not done any of that. The three-judge appellate court said the TSA breached federal law 3 years ago when it formally adopted the scanners as the primary method of screening. The judges, while allowing the scanners to be used, said TSA violated the Administrative Procedures Act by failing to have a 90-day public comment period and ordered the agency to have such a period. Pardon the expression. Pardon everything today. A year later, the government has yet to hold those hearings, and the appellate court has twice denied motions by the plaintiff in the original case to order the TSA to do so. So I guess you can ignore court orders at will as long as you're the TSA. So just shut up and drop them. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
We're so sorry.
First of all, there's a men's magazine down in Australia called The Zoo. Apropos of refugees going to Australia. Yes, Australia, like Britain, Germany, France, Italy, has what they would consider immigration problems, just like the United States. Contrary to the opinions of some conservatives, I'm talking to you, KCRW's Rob Long, that only the United States has people lining up to get in. Australia's refugees are called asylum seekers because they get on boats, usually sold tickets on those boats by brokers in countries like Indonesia, and then cross the ocean to arrive at Australia. And the Zoo has apologized for running a campaign, a contest, a competition to find the hottest asylum seeker. They apologize for that. The top compliance executive for global banking giant HSBC announced during a Senate hearing this week that he will step down from that role. David Bagley, head of compliance, the bank, which has repeatedly failed to stop illegal foreign transactions, money laundering, broke from his prepared testimony to tell the Senate Subcommittee on Investigations that now is the appropriate time for me and the bank for someone new to serve as the head of group compliance. The bank was accused by the subcommittee of serving as a conduit for money from Mexican drug traffickers and Middle Eastern banks with ties to terrorists. Paul Thurston, former head of HSBC's office in Mexico, said when he arrived there, the problems he found frankly took my breath away. All of the executives apologized for the bank's past conduct and promised reform. In Vermont, a county Republican committee chairman apologized for a statement he posted to a party Facebook page that was widely interpreted as a racist attack on President Obama. Rob Towie, the Rutland County Committee chairman, called the statement stupid and insensitive. On Monday, he apologized to Democrats he said were offended by the post. A day later, he apologized to everyone. The original post talked about a 2012 Social Security stimulus package that included cornbread mix, discount coupons to Kentucky Fried Chicken, and a prayer rug. Microsoft has swiftly fixed an embarrassing gaffe, which saw a chunk of code that looked like the words, big boobs. The hexadecimal string was discovered lurking in code that helps a Microsoft program work with Linux open source software. Microsoft swiftly issued a statement. We thank the community for reporting this issue and apologize for the offensive string. It added that it had prepared a patch that would change the spelling of the string in an update. In early June, Microsoft suffered another embarrassment over vulgar language used during a song and dance routine at a company conference. Former New Hampshire Governor John Sununu told CNN he misspoke when he said President Obama needs to, quote, learn to be an American, unquote. But he let stand his comments that Obama doesn't understand America because of his teenage drug use. Hey, dude! And his time as a grade schooler in Indonesia. Sununu did say his learn to be an American was an error. Frankly, I made a mistake, he said. I shouldn't have used those words, and I apologize for using those words. But I don't apologize for the idea that this president has demonstrated he does not understand how jobs are created in America, unquote. They're created by, as far as I know, by big corporate executives saying, let's create some jobs today. What do you say? The chairman of the Toronto Police Services Board apologized to lawful G20 protesters this week at a meeting where the civilian board considered recommendations that the board could have exercised more oversight of the cops. Innocent people had their rights abridged, their liberty interfered with, and their physical safety jeopardized, said Alok Mukherjee, reading from a statement. Not all policing during the summit 2 years ago was within a framework that represented or that respected rights, he said. For that, I am sorry. I extend a very personal apology to those who, though innocent and engaged in lawful and peaceful activities, suffered as a result of the transgressions and failures. George Zimmerman told a national TV audience this week he doesn't regret anything that happened the night he shot and killed 17-year-old Trayvon Martin. I feel like it was all God's plan, he told Sean Hannity on Fox News. Toward the end of the hour-long interview, however, Zimmerman backtracked. I do wish there was something, anything I could have done that wouldn't have put me in a position where I would have had to take a life, he said. I do want to tell everyone I'm sorry that this happened. I hate to think that because of this incident, because of my actions, it has polarized, divided America. I'm truly sorry, unquote. George, relax. You didn't polarize us. The run to the Olympics is being overshadowed by a security shambles. After the main contractor admitted it didn't have enough guards to police the event, the head of security firm G4S, Nick Buckles, can't write him, apologized to a committee of parliament in Britain's House of Commons after he acknowledged the firm was 3,000 people short of the required 10,000 personnel to properly secure the events. Syndicated radio talk show host Neil Bortz quickly backtracked on a tweet he sent out this week when he belittled President Obama's remarks about the tragic shooting in Aurora. Bortz said on Twitter, Obama has made a statement about Colorado shooting. Whew, everything is okay now. Obama is shocked and saddened, unquote. When his tweet was publicized, Bortz sent the blog writer an email that read, Michael, you are exactly right. My tweet was flat out wrong. Certainly is the role of the president to lead the morning at a time like this. I've apologized on Twitter as well. And ABC News has apologized for wrongly linking the suspected gunman in the Aurora shooting to the Tea Party. ABC News correspondent Brian Ross noted during the network's coverage on Friday that a Tea Party website listed a Jim Holmes as a member, Jim Holmes of Aurora, Colorado. ABC later issued a statement that the report was unfounded. Ross also apologized, saying an earlier report was incorrect, that he was connected to a Tea Party. That's a different Jim Holmes. There's room, ladies and gentlemen, in America for more than one Jim Holmes. The Apology of the Week, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
Here's to those who love not too wisely, no, not too wisely, but too well. To the girl who sighs with envy when she hears that wedding bell. To the guy who'd throw a party if he knew someone to call. Here's to the losers, bless them all. Here's to those who drink their dinners when that lady doesn't show. To the girls who wait for kisses underneath that mistletoe. To the lonely summer lovers when the leaves begin to fall. Here's to the losers, bless them all. Hey, Tom, Dick, and Harry, coming out of the rain. Those torches you carry must be drowned in champagne. Here's the last toast of the evening. Here's to those who still believe. All the losers will be winners. All the givers shall receive. Here's to trouble-free tomorrows. May your sorrows all be small. Here's to the losers. Bless them all. Hey, Tom, Dick, and Harry, come in out of that rain. Those torches you carry must be drowned in champagne. Here's the last toast of the evening. Here's to those who still believe. All the losers will be winners. All the givers shall receive. Here's to trouble-free tomorrows. May your sorrows all be small. Here's to the losers. Here's to the losers. Here's to the losers. Bless them all.
This is Le Show, Olympic fever spreading throughout London in this week, leading up to the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games, of course. And we have a special report from our old friend Bill Malone, who has flown over here to be part of our exclusive coverage of the run-up to the Olympics. We're, of course, not allowed to cover the Olympics themselves, but in the week in advance, we are allowed to cover the preparations and build-up to the Games. And Bill is downstairs, I believe, right outside Leicester Square, where we're broadcasting from at this moment. Bill, live coverage here on Le Show. Very exciting. Bill, what do you see from your vantage point?
Harry, I'm in Charing Cross Road, just outside Leicester Square, where you're broadcasting from. And this is the site of where the Olympic torch relay is going to make its latest appearance. Of course, the Olympic torch has been run throughout London all this weekend. And moments from now, the Olympic torch is going to be carried through Trafalgar Square, which is just to the east of us, and here into Charing Cross Road. And there's a big crowd assembled here, a mood of anticipatory excitement, or if you will, excitable anticipation, both of which could be anticipated or anticipated as this Olympic week, this pre-Olympic week, builds to its inevitable climax. That would be the beginning of the Olympics.
Sure.
This is, of course, a city of many squares, Trafalgar Square, Leicester Square, just a few of them, many fewer circles, Harry, and, of course, almost no triangles, just a geometric note for you.
Okay, Bill, good note there. What do you see exactly? Do you, are you seeing the torchbearer running through the Charing Cross Road yet?
That's a negative, Harry. Okay. I'm getting reports from London police as I'm talking to you now, that the runner, the torchbearer in this segment of the Games, of course, is paying tribute to the historic origins of the Olympic torch relay as a ritual, as a tradition, part of the Olympic Games. That tradition originated, of course, in the Berlin Olympics of 1936.
Yep.
And as a tribute, the runner at this point in the relay is supposed to be dressed in an SS uniform, a replica Nazi, as it were. And so that's what we're looking for, to round the corner out of Trafalgar Square and to head here into Charing Cross Road.
Okay, so Bill, I'm assuming that you don't yet have actual sighting of the runner in the Nazi uniform.
That is a nugatory, Harry, but I am just now, as I'm speaking to you live, getting a report from the Metropolitan Police that they have a report from their people on the scene in Trafalgar Square.
Sure.
That apparently, as the runner, we don't have an informer yet on whether that is a male or female, but dressed as the replica Nazi, has been attacked by 20 to 30 members of the quite sizable crowd at Trafalgar Square.
Wow.
And apparently mistaking him or her for a genuine Nazi, and so there is a report that that runner has been downed.
Oh, okay, Bill. As soon as, do you have any idea of a report on the condition of the torch at this point, which is of course carrying the Olympic flame?
That's of course correct, Harry. Although it is no one should be concerned. That is a flame that is of course carried by relay from Athens, the birth of the historic Olympics, to the Olympic Stadium, and the idea is that it's an unbroken, if you will, a string of flame. But no one is to be worried. This does not in any way impact the ability to light the flame at the light the torch that's going to be burning at the Olympic Stadium. This is one of several replica flames, if you will.
Yes.
So we have no idea, though, about the condition of the torch at this time, and we're going to effort to get you that as soon as we can.
Of course. All right, Bill Malone, thank you for being on the spot, but seeing nothing at your location at Charing Cross Road, and we will try to get an update on the condition of the flame as soon as we can. Live coverage of the Olympic torch relay here on Le Show.
brothers-in-laws. When the race has all been run, when the storm has left your sheep well torn, ignore the cost, get your stars uncrossed, back at square one.
Just be prepared.
You can always find a way.
Just be prepared.
No matter what they say, life is just a wheel.
From the semi-unofficial British Olympic News Centre, here's another Olympic update. I'm Simon Aldridge. There has been a ring of almost unbreakable secrecy around plans for the reportedly elaborate and spectacular opening ceremony for the Olympic Games. But a leaked report from observers who've seen rehearsals for the ceremony this week offers a tantalising glimpse of what's on offer for those in the stadium as well as the billions watching on television worldwide. In a stunning departure from form, all the country's fielding teams in the synchronized swimming events have agreed that their team members will march into the stadium totally out of synchronization. I'm Simon Aldridge. That's your Olympic update.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of our friend the Atom.
Clean, safe. Save to meter. Save.
Eddie, the Atom, are you excited?
I'm always excited. I'm in a state of excitement. It's my nature.
Okay, good. Eddie the Atom, ladies and gentlemen, is excited. The operator of Japan's crippled Fuk nuclear plant was told this week it could hike consumer bills by around 8.5%. The president of the company insisted that it was misunderstood by the public.
I misunderstand it.
Tokyo Electric Power had wanted to ramp up customer bills by more than 10% to help pay ballooning costs in the aftermath of the disaster, but was told to rein in its rise. Hours after winning government approval for the huge hike, TEPCO President Naomi Hirose said the reduced rise would cause the cost the company more than $1 billion a year, and said there was a perception gap in the way the utility was seen. He told the Foreign Correspondents Club of Japan he would do his best to win back public trust in the utility. I think that someday in the very near future, people, our customers, or society will be convinced that TEPCO is changing. TEPCO is moving towards very positive information, he said.
I trust him.
That's an Adam's eye view of the world. Deadline Tokyo, Japan's health ministry said it would investigate reports that workers at the stricken Fuk plant were urged by a subcontractor to place lead around radiation detection devices in order to stay beneath the safety threshold for exposure to radiation.
It works.
The Asahi Shimbun newspaper reported that an executive from Buildup, a subcontractor to the plant owner TEPCO, told workers to cover dosimeters when working in high radiation areas. Dosimeters can be worn as badges or carried as devices around the size of a smartphone to detect radiation. 9 workers wore the lead plates around the dosimeters after the executive's plea, according to one of the broadcast companies in Japan, citing the subcontractor's president. You have nothing to say about that.
It works. Lead blocks radiation.
Okay. A radiation from Japan's Fuk nuclear disaster may eventually cause approximately 130 deaths and 180 cases of cancer, mostly in Japan, Stanford researchers have calculated.
Glad you don't live in Japan.
The estimates have large uncertainty ranges, but contrast with previous claims that the radioactive release would likely cause no severe health effects. The numbers are in addition to the roughly 600 deaths caused by the evacuation of the area surrounding the plant. Stanford civil engineering professor Mark Jacobson and his a recent PhD graduate, John Tenhove, published their findings in the journal Energy and Environmental Science. This is the first detailed analysis of the event's global health effects. Jacobson stressed, however, that none of the calculations expressed the full scope of a nuclear disaster. There's a lot more to the issue than what we examined, which were the cancer-related health effects. He said Fuk was such a large disaster in terms of soil and water contamination, displacement of lives, cost, and anguish, unquote. But most of the radioactivity of Fuk was dumped in the Pacific. Only 19% of the released material was deposited over land, keeping the exposed population relatively small.
Unless you're a fish.
Unless you're a fish. Dateline Idaho Falls, Idaho. The city's so nice, they named it twice and put a falls in the middle. U.S. Department of Energy officials said the agency will likely miss its deadline for cleaning up radioactive liquid waste at the Idaho National Laboratory. Tom D'Agostino, the DOE's Nuclear Security Undersecretary, said the department won't have all 900,000 gallons of sodium-bearing waste removed by the end of this year because a facility built to package the waste isn't yet online. An agreement between the federal government and the state of Idaho requires that all liquid waste at the site be removed from tanks above the Eastern Snake River Aquifer by 2013. DOE began building the plant in 2007 to condense the liquid into a powder similar to laundry detergent.
Laundry detergent can't hurt you.
Which would then be stored on site. But a filter at the facility was clogged with non-radioactive material in June, and the contractor is still working to diagnose and correct the problem. Non-radioactive stuff clogging the filter. How do you diagnose that? Until it's fixed, the building will remain shut down. No fines will be levied if the deadline is missed. There's your accountability. In a hat. The Japan Environment Ministry plans to ensure radioactive waste, speaking of waste from the meltdown in Fuk, will be disposed of outside Fuk Prefecture, but no location has been named
and for at least 30 years, the debris will be stored locally, sources said.
Store locally, think globally.
Interesting. The ministry is considering revising a special law on the handling of radioactive waste from the Fuk plant to add a provision requiring the final disposal to be made at places other than Fuk. That reflects requests from communities in the prefecture. And the ministry is also mulling adding another provision limiting the use of planned temporary storage facilities for the waste up to 30 years. That would say the final disposal must be completed outside Fuk within 30 years. Good luck with that. About 20 criminal complaints and accusations have been submitted in connection with last year's Fuk accident. Prosecutors have taken action on precisely none of those cases, according to the Asahi Shimbun. There is your accountability. In fact, they have not formally accepted a single complaint or accusation to determine if a criminal investigation is warranted. Prosecutors have cited the difficulties in obtaining evidence for indictments. Even a former prosecutor, however, has expressed surprise that no criminal investigation has been opened into the worst nuclear accident in Japan's history.
We're looking forward. I'm spinning forward.
That would be your spin. Japan is reviewing seismological data on nuclear plants, the trade minister said this week, as fears mount over the danger from earthquakes after media reports that a second plant in 3 months had been found to be sitting atop a fault line in Japan. And contractors at several U.S. government nuclear facilities have routinely mishandled explosives, unnecessarily endangering the lives of employees and the public, according to a Department of Energy Inspector General's report, which says that contractors that operate four sites that handle nuclear materials did not fully comply with the Explosive Safety Manual, a 500-page guide to handling and storing explosives. The sites in question are at Los Alamos and Sandia National Laboratories, which perform nuclear weapons testing, Idaho National Laboratory, which researches nuclear energy, and Savannah River, which focuses on nuclear waste. The report said management at the sites took immediate action in response to the Inspector General's recommendations. However, the labs did not comply with all the IG's recommendations. For example, workers at the Idaho lab continue to inspect explosive shipments at the lab's main gate, which endangers hundreds of employees who pass through the gate daily.
They should use the other entrance.
They should use the other entrance. Clean, cheap, too safe to meter. Our friend, the Adam. Thank you, Addy.
My pleasure. I'm excited.
And ladies and gentlemen, our final waiting moments here, news of the oil spill in the Gulf. With the oil continuing to show up on beaches and in wetlands along Louisiana's coast, you don't see that in the commercials. The Louisiana Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority passed a resolution criticizing the Coast Guard for prematurely allowing BP to pull cleanup teams away from coastal areas that it declares clean. The authority passed a second resolution requesting the governor's office and the state attorney general's office to brief its members on whether any of the state's criminal statutes could be applied to BP. Any bets? We've pretty much reached an impasse with the Coast Guard, says a governor's office attorney handling legal issues involving the spill. They continue to tell us no in different ways. The big mat of solidified oil was uncovered by waves last month during a low tide at a Grand Isle beach. Similar patches of oil are likely not being seen in remote areas of the coast, according to the authority spokesman. Chairman Garrett Graves said state and parish officials have been meeting with the Coast Guard monthly, but have gotten little satisfaction. There are continued efforts to reduce the response capabilities that are in place in Louisiana, said Graves. They're refusing to do any type of monitoring efforts, despite the fact you have very live, ongoing oiling, like that tar mat that was found just 2 weeks ago in Grand Isle. But the commercials look good. News of the spill, ladies and gentlemen. Because where else? Well, in the at NOLA.com, I guess. If when the newspaper bothers to come out, you'd read about it. But otherwise, here. And a typical show chapeau to the president and CEO of PBS, who defended dropping Fred Willard from the new PBS show Market Warriors after he was arrested in Hollywood and an adult theater for alleged lewd conduct. said Paula Kerger of PBS, of Willard. His circumstances would have become a distraction for the series. That is to say, I'm interpreting her now, it would have made viewers want to watch. Please give. Well, we're nearing time when we have to leave the air. Still no report on that torch. So stay tuned to your public radio station. That will be just one of the things that will not be considered. And that concludes this week's edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe on the USN 440 cable system in Japan. Around the world through the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.490 megahertz, on the mighty 104 in Berlin, on your smartphone through Stitcher.com, available as a free podcast through KCRW.com, and available live and archived whenever you want it at two different locations on the internet, HarryShearer.com and KCRW.com. And it'd be just like having a wonderful, safe, and happy Olympic Games, if you'd agree to join me again. Would you? All right. Thank you very much. Uh-huh. A typical show chapeau to the San Diego, Pittsburgh, Chicago, and Hawaii desks. Thanks, as always, to Pam Halstead, and thanks to Adrian Bodnam here at Global Radio in London, England, for making today's the show 59 minutes in length. Show comes to you from Century of Progress and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the Rubber Promise and the home of the homeless. So long from London.